Hi, this is Gideon Roth Rothstein. This is a response of a day for the 23rd day of Kislev. And today we're going to see a response of the Tzitzili Ezer in volume 16, response number 4, Ted Zion Dalet, date of the 23rd of Kislev, Tufshin Mem Gimel, 1982. Let's thank Rabbi Jacob Bromwich, David Hachhauser, and the OU for their help in putting these shiurim online, make them available to you. And I want to point out before we start that the issue that the Tzitzili is going to take up, is going to take up a specific instance of a very broad issue that I think is very relevant to many people today, and that's the question of when we are obligated to reveal negative information about others. As he's going to quote later, Pirkei Tshuva is going to say that he sees all these people talking about Lashon Hara and how terrible that it is, and that he, the Pirkei Tshuva, feels that it's even more serious, that there are a lot of people who don't divulge information that needs to be divulged. So the case at hand was a doctor contacts Tzilias. Tzilias was for many, many years the posik for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. So not only for Shaarei Tzedek, he got many medical questions because he was known to be an expert in that issue. He was also, and it's sort of relevant to something he's going to say in the Tshuva as well, he also served on the Beit Din, and he got appeals that we've seen together, some of them, appeals of divorce cases. So he also knows how divorce cases go, and that's going to be a little bit relevant to our conversation. So the doctor contacts him, and the doctor is, I think, some kind of a gynecological doctor, but like a gynecological plastic surgeon, because the case was he'd been taking care of a young single woman, an unmarried, I should say, a young unmarried woman who was about 19 years old, and she was born with a physical problem, that she didn't have a uterus, she didn't have a womb, right? She didn't have any of those, of that part of her anatomy wasn't there, and she also didn't have genitalia in the sense that would allow for ordinary marital intercourse. So she asked the doctors to construct something plastically, you know, or however doctors do it, to construct something with flaps of skin, to graft, whatever, so that she could engage in such relations, so that she could get married, she could have relationships with a man, and that it would have the sense and the feel of marital relations. I don't know, we don't know, the Tshuva doesn't tell us other bad things about her, and who would choose to get married, who would not choose to get married, how it would happen, but that's what happened. So they did it for her, and it was very successful. And they explained to her that they can do this, and they can create a circumstance in which it will be like she can have relations, but it's not like they can construct for her all the reproductive apparatus that she didn't have. She's not going to be able to have children. So they did it, and it was very successful, and he was so successful, said the doctor, that unless you're a professional, you'll have no idea, right, from the outside, or even if you're involved in intimate relations with her, you'll have no idea that this is not an ordinary woman. Now she's engaged, right? She's engaged to a man, to a young man. He's referred to as a bachor, right? He's a young man, and he doesn't know. She hasn't told him. And she's asked the doctors in every way. She's pleaded with them. She's begged with them not to tell the boy, the young man, her situation. So she's planning on hiding it from him. So the doctor contacts the CS, wants to know, am I required to tell this kid if he doesn't come to me? So the one question would be if he comes to me. Second question would be if he doesn't come to me, do I have to volunteer the information with him, especially since it seems like he might have promised her that he would, and there's also the code of professional ethics in terms of medical confidentiality. Then he says, is there perhaps some relationship between this and a case that he, the doctor, felt confident the answer to, and that he was correct about it, was let's suppose that instead of this being the case, let's suppose the young woman had some kind of a infectious disease, but there's another word, communicable disease. Let's say she had a disease that if she gets married to him, she will give him some serious disease. Let's say, you know, AIDS would be an example, where you have ordinary intercourse, ordinary relations, the person you have a relationship with is likely to get it as well. So there it was clear that you have to tell the person because you're physically protecting them from getting a physical illness that can be very serious. And then the doctor throws in, and it's worth throwing in, just so that we don't get the wrong idea. It happens to be this case was a woman who was not interested in telling the man important information, but the question is easily reversible. Let's suppose that for some reason there's a man who's unable to have children. He knows he's unable to have children, and there's no way he's able to have children. And he also is about to get married. He's not going to tell his partner that he's unable to have children. Would the doctor be obligated or required or allowed or whatever to tell the woman in question that, you know, the man you're marrying has this issue? So I think this is a question I found so interesting and so broadly applicable that even though the question is from the 23rd of Kislev, I bent my rules a little bit. And I have to say, when I start looking at all this at the end to try to see what we have as a whole mass, I'm not sure what the percentages of responses that are actually written on the date that I have. I think it's still way over 90%, but I feel myself saying a lot of times, so I cheat a little bit here, I cheat a little bit there. I feel like it's got to be at least once a month that I cheat. Anyway, So in this case, the response is actually from the 6th of Tevet of Tafshin Mem Gimel. I could have put it that, but I had another response for that. So a few days later, he answers him, and he says, I think you're obligated to. And his sources are, there's a Rambam in the first chapter of Hilchot Rotzeach Ushmir HaNefesh, the 14th halakha, where the Rambam says, and this is an important halakha for us to know as well, having it's relevant to this case, it applies to this case, but it applies very broadly. If you can save somebody else, their life is the first example, and you choose not to, you violate the Torah. And so too, if you see somebody drowning in the sea, in the water, and either you can save them, or you could hire, there's a whole discussion about the manuscript version of what he really wrote, but you could hire somebody, and you don't, or, and now it gets even more than just about saving lives. Sheshama akumi. Here's non-Jews, O Mosrim, or Jews who will turn Jews over, other Jews over to non-Jews. He hears them talking about doing something evil, and here I don't think it has to mean killing them, and he doesn't warn the person, or he knows that somebody's going to come and try to steal money from you or take things from you forcefully, and you could, in this case, he says, you could not just warn the intended victim, but you could convince them not to. And here, let's say there's a non-Jew that I'm friendly with, and this non-Jew, or there's a Jew that I'm friendly with, and they're planning on doing something bad to somebody else, and I know that if I speak to them, they'll change their minds, or they'll refrain, or whatever it is, and I just say, yeah, what's my business? In all those situations, the Rambam says, in anything like that, you are over alo tamor adam reyecha. You violate the prohibition in the Torah of you can't stand by. So adam reyecha doesn't only mean literally your friend, your colleague Jew's blood. It means their damage. And in Choshen Mishpat, in the Shulchan Aruch, in Tav Chaf Vav, he says it in the broadest version. Anybody who stands by and sees and has a way to save his friend from any evil that could befall them, not just murder. And you can save them either physically, or you can save them by convincing the perpetrator, the evildoer, not to do it, or you can warn the guy, or whatever it is you could do, and you don't. So all of that falls under the category of lo tamor adam reyecha. How does that apply here? Because here, this doctor knows that this woman intends to do something terrible to her intended, to her fiancé. What's the thing is that she can't have children. So if they get married and she can't have children, that means he can't have children. So he won't be able to fulfill his mitzvah period of Arivia. He won't be able to be involved in building up the world. And then one day he's going to have to find out. And when he has to find out, it's going to be terrible for him. Why is it going to be terrible for him? Well, he's going to have bad choices in front of him. Because, first of all, it can cause him to fall physically ill or psychologically ill. To know, meaning the betrayal of somebody you thought loved you, you thought you were building a life with, and to realize that they withheld this very, very relevant information. This, and it's going to stop you from doing what you had thought you were going to be building a life together for. And he doesn't know it, and he's going after her, and then how could you imagine that that's not obligatory to save a guy from that? So that's when people start to say, well, it's not so terrible. And it says, you might say to yourself, it's not so terrible. Why would you say it's not so terrible? You could say, when he finds out, he can say, she fooled me, and therefore I want to get right away. Now, there's a pause to say, and by the way, when we say she fooled me, so that brings up a topic that's also on the table in many circles today. People like to talk about it, but Tzvi Ezra is talking in 1982. He already says that you can't just uproot the Kiddushin and say it never happened, because after all, she fooled me in such a major way. Today, it's often in the reverse. You'll have women who would like to say, not that they're lying about it, they would like to say that the level of fraud that was in the marriage should mean that we can just nullify the marriage to begin with, because a fraudulent marriage shouldn't be a marriage. So here, this is clearly something that was so fraudulent. If he immediately says, I can't be married anymore because I want to have children and you lied to me and you this, and he wants up for the marriage, you'd think that would be a classic example of a mekach tot, of a fraudulent marriage. So the Tzitzel just says, and so he's saying it about where it's the man who's going to be. It's not like there's a gender-biased agenda here. He says you can't do that because when they did the wedding, he never said out loud this condition. And that you're going to be Kudesh to me, al-minat, that you have no knowledge. You have to say something like that, you have no knowledge that you can't have children. Since he didn't make that condition, any condition, then the wedding is a wedding. So that's situation is really not talking about a situation where it gets more difficult and problematic. Usually it comes up, let's say, where, sadly, a man doesn't realize that if a marriage is over, he has to give his wife a get, and he's trying to withhold the get. And therefore, the woman will say, I don't want to go through the whole rigmarole of the get. I'll just point out that there was fraud here, and therefore uproot the marriage. So let's assume for a second there was the fraud there. It's still not at all clear that you can simply uproot it as a mekach tot, especially the Tzitzit Eliezer is assuming here that it didn't have an explicit condition made. So he can't do that. But what he can do is, he can say, I want to have a get. I want to get divorced. So that he can do. Right? He can insist on a get as soon as he finds out. But, so people will say, so what's the big deal? They'll get married. They'll try to have children for a little while. They won't be able to have children. Eventually, she'll have to reveal the news. And if he's upset about it, he'll get a divorce. So the Tzitzit Eliezer says, you can't say such a thing. Because first of all, you're trapping him into a situation. Who knows how long it's going to be? Maybe he's a trusting guy. Maybe he'll believe her that she's just having trouble conceiving, and they'll go to a fertility doctor, and she'll convince that fertility doctor not to tell him, and who knows how long she'll keep the charade going, right? So that's one big problem. You're cheating him of years of his life. But also, says Tzitzit Eliezer, people don't want to get divorced, and especially if, let's assume for a second that everything else about the relationship is good, then 5 years in, 6 years in, 10 years in, he's got all this emotional investment in the relationship, and now he finds out that she lied to him the entire time and he has to break it up. It's devastating. So it's devastating. You can't cause somebody devastation. You can't plan to cause somebody devastation like that, and that at the end he's going to have to go through that situation. And then he says, and by the way, he says, Umi chamoni yodea kama kasher, who knew better than me knows how easy it is. He says how hard it is. What he means is how hard it is sometimes to get a divorce. Especially, let's say, if this young woman is feeling like nobody will want to marry her, and I don't know if that's true. We'll get to that at the end. I'll throw that in at the end of the discussion. We're thinking about her lack of confidence that people will be willing to marry her. That's an interesting question to think about. But let's say, for now, she's convinced nobody will marry her, so she's so convinced of it, now she found the guy who's willing to marry her, she's insistent that nobody tell him, because she's sure that he'll dump her, meaning, for all we know, when you tell him, he might say, it's terrible. But it's terrible for her, it's terrible for me. I have found myself to be in love with her. I have found myself to be building a life with her. She is my, intended, she is my bashert, as it were. We're going to get married and we'll work it out. We'll adopt, we'll this, we'll that, whatever it is. But we're together. It could happen, there are plenty of women who are and know ahead of time they're infertile and find men who are happy to marry them. They have happy relationships and they build their lives however they build their lives. So it's a possibility. This young woman clearly doesn't think that it's a likelihood, and it may not be. I'm not doubting her self-assessment. But that in that situation, when you have a woman like that who's that desperate and feels that way, especially if she gets proven right that as soon as this guy finds out, let's say 5 years down the road, that she can't have children, that she lied to him. Now, I would say maybe he would be getting rid of her because she lied to him rather than because she can't have children. But let's say, so she can make it very difficult for him. And so she says, nobody knows better than me. I see these cases all the time. And the case that I've seen and I've spoken about in these shiurim of the Tzitzit Eliezer and the Revel Yosef on divorces that go bad, these are cases that take years and years and years. Right? You see the dates on the appeal and the this, and they go back to court and they're this, and it's court procedure. So it's not necessary that you have to do these things, but you can drag them out a long, long time. So it's not so obviously simple that he can just get a divorce. She can drag it out. And this says, Yamim al-Shadim, it could be days and years. And then a lot of times, not only is it a matter of time, it's also huge amounts of money just to go through the court procedure and then to convince her to accept the get. It takes a long time. So you can say, well, you know what, the man, and this is another claim that people make, and the Tzitzit is in a well-positioned and well-placed to know that it's not as good an argument as people make it out to be. You can say, well, then he can get a heter me'arav on him. And let's say she refuses to accept the get, he can get 100 rabbanim to sign off on the fact that he's allowed to get married again and marry a second wife. So there is such a possibility, but the Tzitzit Eliezer says, it's not so simple, right? It takes a long time, it takes a lot of effort, lots of things happen to people, and by the time it's all over, he's gone through so much to either give her a divorce against her will, sometimes the court will allow, or they'll allow him to marry somebody else, but and that's even when he's right, when he's fully right, and he gets at the end, then not everybody's going to want to get married to him, because if you know this complicated history that he has, you as a woman might not want to take on, meaning, let's say you as a woman know that he got a heter me'arav on him. That means there's this other woman out there. So I think a lot of these cases, once the man has gotten the Heter Merabanim, and part of the Heter Merabanim of the having 100 rabbis sign that he can marry a second wife, is he has to leave a get for her with the Beit Din. I think in many, many of the cases, the woman, the first wife, takes the get then at that point, because what's the point of fighting it anymore? But if somebody gets it into her head that she wants to continue fighting it, she can make life unpleasant. So the Tzidur says, so this guy is going to not necessarily be so simple for him to find another wife. All of that being reason to say that this is information that he is owed. This is information that he deserves to have, and that you're saving him from, you're actively saving him from the easy possibility of hard times and of difficult experiences by telling this ahead of time. When you're refraining from returning to him his lost body, his lost health, his lost money, if you don't tell this ahead of time. And he says, I'm going to leave aside, he has a small little discussion he thinks worth talking about another thing. He says, I'm not even positive that you're allowed to marry this woman. Different discussion. Let's leave that for another time. But let's assume that theoretically they can get married, but he says he has to have the information. And by the way, he says that it's the reverse as well. If a young man wants to get married to a young woman, and we know that he can't have children, he doesn't want to tell her. So the Chazal talk about the fact that for all that women don't have a technical obligation to have children, right? Halachically, we understand the technical obligation to be upon men, but part of the reason for that is that we think that the Chazal think that women want to have children. One of the reasons that women in the time of Chazal wanted to have children was they wanted somebody who was going to help them in their old age. Children were sort of like an insurance policy. It's not the only reason, but something that Chazal understood that women want to have children. So if women want to have children and a young man is going to get married and he's unable to have children, we got to tell a young woman. You have to tell her because this is information that she deserves to have. And then he quotes the Pirkei Tshuva that I mentioned before. There's an Orach Chaim Kuf Nun Vav where the Pirkei Tshuva says, Kol Sifrei HaMusar, all of the ethical works, all of the books that are trying to get us to be better Jews and better people. So they all talk about Lashon Hara. He says he's living before the Chafetz Chaim, the Pirkei Tshuva. He's trying to, even before the Chafetz Chaim, got even more into talking about Lashon Hara issues and making people aware of it, and trying to help people understand that they're not allowed to speak Lashon Hara. And he says, but I think it's even the worst, the greater sin is the opposite. And I think it's more prevalent, which I think is interesting. Because if you had asked me, which is more prevalent, people withholding information they needed to tell or people telling bad information they shouldn't be telling, I would have thought, I think they're both bad, but I would have thought Lashon Hara was more prevalent. He's saying in his time, he thinks it's more prevalent, it's more around there, it's more out there, that there's information that people deserve to have and nobody's telling it to them and they're suffering for it. Refraining from speaking in a place where you're supposed to be speaking to save somebody from being cheated. So an easy example would be, let's say, I know that somebody's a swindler and I know that there's a Bernie Madoff out there and I don't say anything. The worst is I recommend people to go in with him. But I just don't say anything. So that's a terrible thing because I'm letting people get caught up in a swindle and lose maybe their life savings. And that's part of what the Pirkei Tshuva was talking about. And also, he says, with shiduchim, when couples, and that's our case here, and the thing, but it comes up in many cases, when it comes to people getting engaged, people getting going out, especially in, so I live in a world where many times people will date, which means they'll meet on their own, or they'll go out for extended periods of time. So even there, you can have people who go out for a year and 2 years and even, you know, and I'm not saying that you should or shouldn't, but you go out for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and you get married and you find out there's all this information you didn't know. And then there were people who did know this information. So the withholding of information says the Pirkei Tshuva with Shiduchim. So it's all the more so in the more, whatever the right word term for those people would be, in the communities where people date for shorter periods of time and were more arranged by the family, and the dating is somewhat more of a formality, and so you find out some stuff by dating, but you expect to find a lot of stuff out by checking that you do, and people withhold information. So that's all part of withholding, of not returning lost items to these people. You're setting them up to lose their time, their effort, their money on a marriage that's not going to work out, and you could have helped protect them from that, and you're supposed to reveal that information. And then the Tzitzila says, and I even saw in the Chafetz Chaim, now it's even because Chafetz Chaim is very known for opposing Lashon Hara, so you'd think he'd be very machmir on allowing us to talk negatively about people. The Chafetz Chaim wrote, he paskins before Rash explicitly, that if you know in negative information that will help somebody, save somebody from this, then you shouldn't worry about the Lashon Hara issue. And he explains there, the Chafetz Chaim, in his commentary, they call Be'er Mayim Chaim, he explains that the permissibility of it is, even when she's already engaged, or he's already engaged, let's say a couple's engaged, and I didn't have a chance, right? It wasn't around before they got engaged, now they're engaged, and I know something very relevant, very important for one side or the other to know, even if I have every belief, if I have every reason to believe that it will break up the engagement, the truth is the opposite way down. The Chofetz Chaim says, even if I know it might break up the engagement, I think it's the other way around. I think it's, especially if it's the kind of information that is likely to break up the engagement, that's clearly when I have to speak up. So the Chofetz Chaim has some doubt there, but let's say I'm the only witness who knows this information. It's only one person who knows it, and you might say that in halach, in general, we only believe when there are two witnesses, we don't believe just one witness, but the titulars are fundamentally things that it doesn't matter, and here it doesn't matter, he says, because the first of all, there are many more than one person who knows this information. The doctor is the one who might tell the young man what happened and what they did, but there are plenty of people involved in procedures. A lot of people know about it, so it's not like it's one witness, like he's the only one who knows about it. You have that situation sometimes too, and that's more complicated, but that's not this situation. And besides which, she can go for a medical exam. So let's say the doctor goes to the guy, and the guy says, "How do I know this? How do I know you're not just lying?" The answer is, let her go for a medical exam with the doctor, and let the doctor tell the doctor, yeah, and you can tell the boy what we find out. So obviously, she's not going to do that because it'll be clear that that's the situation. So this is a very easily discoverable reality. It's not like a one witness situation, but you have to be aware that you should be on the lookout for it. He has no idea. So you might think that, let's say the doctor promised her he wouldn't reveal anything. So it says it doesn't matter. He says, we see a Ramah in Yel Redeya, who says, let's say somebody took an oath not to reveal certain information that would save somebody else from a financial loss. The Ramah paskins that counts as being a nishba levatel hamitzvah. It counts as like taking an oath to nullify a commandment, meaning taking an oath to say, I won't fulfill the Torah. And the halacha is that you can't take such oaths because the Gemara understands that all Jewish people, all of us as Jews, are nishmushba'im me'omdim me'har Sinai. We already made an oath at Sinai that we would follow the Torah. So we can't take a later oath to not follow the Torah. Now, there are technical ways in which one can make it impossible by oath to fulfill a mitzvah, and that's a problem. But fundamentally, if somebody just simply said, I swear not to do X mitzvah, that oath doesn't take effect. It's not that they're not allowed to fulfill the oath. It's that the oath doesn't take effect. So here, the Ramah is saying, if somebody swears to somebody else, they won't reveal certain information, but that information is information that will protect that other person from loss, or will help that other person protect him or herself from loss. Ramah says it doesn't even take effect as an oath, let alone a promise like the doctor made to her, because there's an obligation, a mitzvah obligation to reveal this information. Now, it is true, as the Ramah says, that it's better to do a hatarat nedarim, or like to be matir the shivua, the oath or the promise, before you can do that. So you can do that. You go to a chacham and you say, listen, I made this promise. Turns out that's a promise that was erroneous promise to make, and the chacham and the rabbi, and the chacham, the wise man, will tell you, you're right, and we'll be matir the nether. So you should do that, but that's almost a technicality, meaning it's almost like it's not really necessary because the oath didn't really take effect. But it's better to do a Hataras Nedarim just because it helps us be sure that even to those opinions that say no, it's not clearly enough of a Dvar Mitzvah, of a Mitzvah obligation, that the oath wouldn't take effect. So you've at least been Matir Neder. But you should do that. So you should do that. Now that Ramah also says that it's the Ezer. Helps us with another issue you might raise. You might raise the issue that when this man, or whoever the doctor is, in this case he's a man, it could be a woman, whoever it was who's the doctor, they often will have taken a Hippocratic oath, or for many Orthodox Jews, they'll take, I think, a Maimonidean version of the Hippocratic oath. The Rambam wrote a version of that promise that doctors make that doesn't run afoul of various halakhic issues. So he took a promise, and part of that oath is, as everybody knows, to maintain doctor-patient confidentiality. So you're going to violate that. So according to the Ramah that we just read, you could say, and even the Maimonidean oath doesn't apply to these kinds of situations. The Hippocratic oath, if you took that one, doesn't apply to these kinds of situations because you had a prior obligation. That's another important halakhic concept people don't always realize, that we believe that all Jews have prior obligations from the time of birth, and that oaths that they take cannot affect those. But in this case, it's a little more complicated because this Hippocratic or Maimonidean oath, whichever version the doctor took, will take effect. The Ramah had said an oath to not tell that information, let's say, can't take effect because it's a clear violation, right? Let's say somebody says, I'm going to rob so-and-so of $1 million and makes me swear not to tell. So that's an oath that doesn't take effect because the whole oath is, according to the Ramah, is simply a violation of my obligation to protect my fellow Jew from loss, financial or otherwise. That's good as far as it goes, but that reasoning won't take us all the way in the case of the Hippocratic or Maimonidean oath, because those oaths do take effect on other situations. Right? When you have an oath, it's a shivua, that covers both things that it can affect and things that it can affect, then it's an oath that took effect, it just didn't fully take effect. So there, the Tzitzilayasha thinks that for sure you need a Hataras Nedarim because of that situation, because it is in some sense a valid oath. And once it's in some sense a valid oath, it might also actually take effect on the Dvar Mitzvah as well, and therefore you might need to do Hataras Nedarim, and therefore he recommends that. He says possibly, there's an argument the other way, you could possibly say that when this Orthodox doctor, when this Jewish from observant doctor took the original medical oath, he had in mind, you can assume he or she had in mind that they wouldn't cover any situation that halacha doesn't allow for. So if you had that in mind, then maybe you don't need Hataras Nedarim now because it never covered it for that situation because you had a specific exception in mind, but that's just a possibility. We don't have to go through that into that significantly. So fundamentally, he thinks doctors, and obviously this would be true of others as well, have no obligation to withhold information that will damage others. It could be damage communities, it could damage individuals, but if any Jew who knows information that if the fellow Jew were to have that information would help them protect themselves from loss of various sorts, physical, financial, psychological, emotional, all of those situations, one would be obligated by Torah law to reveal it to that person. And therefore, even if you made a promise, maybe you should do Hataras Nedarim. In some cases, you should. Some cases, you don't need to. But so maybe in all cases, you should just in case. But you have to reveal the information. That's what he says. That's halacha. Then he throws in. He says, and I want to give you a piece of advice. I think it's a very valuable piece of advice. And he throws in at the end. He says, before you tell the boy, you have to tell the boy. But before you tell the boy, maybe invite the girl in for a talk. And calmly and gently explain to her that you're not going to be able to hold this confidence because there's the Torah requirement that you reveal this information, and maybe she'll agree that she'll have the conversation with the boy, and then she can do it in a way that's not so embarrassing to her. Meaning, if the doctor does it, it's terrible. He clearly looks like she's been trying to trick him into something and trying to trap him into a marriage and this and this and this, and it's terrible. But if you can just convince her that she should talk to the boy herself, then that's even better, because then they can have the conversation. Now, it still doesn't go further, but theoretically, the doctor could offer to be, you know, there as a third party, and he could try to help it out, and he could try to help them, and maybe that the boy will be convinced, you know, there could be something, work something out, they can stay together in some way. There's a whole set of questions as to how you handle these things. You know, in our times of surrogacies, maybe they would find a rav who would say that the boy can, you know, have a surrogate carry a child for them, and they'll raise this child together, and he'll have fulfilled it to a period of rivia, and she'll be able to mother. There's all sorts of possibilities. But the important, crucial piece that comes out of this, and it moves me greatly because I unfortunately know of cases, more than one case, too many cases, where information is withheld, and that creates terrible problems for people, for innocent people who had no idea. And just because people were afraid to reveal information, and so sometimes information that once revealed would have necessarily, you know, the people who were hiding the information would be hurt by other people knowing it, but nonetheless they have to do it. And sometimes where another option could have been found if only they had known ahead of time. So as a reminder here is that confidentiality is not always something that's required. It's not always something that's valuable. And there are plenty of times when it's better to tell people what's going on so they can know ahead of time and protect themselves from what can eventually become, if you don't tell them, terrible tragedies, as unfortunately happens too often. So that's a response from a day that we learned on the 23rd of Kislev. Tzitzilayasar in Tet Zayin Dalet about when doctors, but really when everybody, has to tell other people information that they deserve to have that will help them protect themselves from any kind of loss, whether it might be loss of life, loss of bodily health, loss of physical health, emotional health, mental health, or even just money. All those are situations where one Jew would be obligated to reveal what they know to their fellow Jew. That's responsibility for the 23rd of Kislev. Thanks to the OU, Jacob Bromwitz, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hochhauser. I bid you a good day.